Good afternoon. This is Division 6 of the Colorado Court of Appeals. On our docket this morning, we have two cases. This afternoon, we have two cases. 08CA 1897, Reby against Mountain States Mutual Casualty Company. Our counsel here for both sides on that case.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. And at the conclusion of that case, we'll hear 09CA 575, Park Lake Resources against Park County Board of Equalization. Are the attorneys here on that case?
Yes, Your Honor. Present, Your Honor.
Thank you. Have you all received our standard instructions for arguments at the Court of Appeals? Are there any questions? There being no questions, I just ask everyone, please check your cell phones, make sure they're turned off, and we'll begin our oral arguments. The appellant may argue.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. Mark Bendinelli, may it please the court. Counsel. You let me know when I should commence.
Please.
We're here this afternoon on a case that was tried in Denver District Court approximately a year and a half ago. And I tried that case. I'm trial counsel. I've never been to the Court of Appeals and probably should have deferred to my most talented co-counsel, Tim Fowler, to handle oral argument. But since I tried the case, I knew a lot of the facts and details and elected to handle this. Following a two-week jury trial where Mindy Reby had filed suit against Mountain States to obtain coverage, the district court judge entered a JNOV in favor of Mountain States, which we believe was in light of credible and plentiful evidence to support the jury's finding. Ms. Reby, by way of background, Ms. Reby had lived with her fiance who owned a company called New Horizons. And Ms. Reby provided services to that company. Intermittently, she would run errands for that company. Most notably, the owner of that company, which was her fiance, had no car insurance for a year, lost the ability to drive. So she was his primary transportation for all of his company activities.
Mr. Bendinelli, at the time of this accident, was there any evidence before the trial court that Ms. Reby was driving the car for a purpose for the benefit of New Horizons?
Yes, Your Honor. And in fact, New Horizons, in light of that consideration, had supplied her.
What was the errand she was on at the time of the accident?
Oh, she was not on an errand at the time of the accident. But it was plaintiff established during the trial that there was an insurable interest. The New Horizons had an insurable interest in that vehicle because she lived with the owner of the company. He didn't have a driver's license for a year at the time that this vehicle was added to the policy, and she was providing services to New Horizons. Although she's a single mother, and at the time of this accident, she had her two girls with her, and it was in the evening, so it was not on company business.
Pardon me for interrupting, Mr. Bendinelli.
Yes,
sir. May, please. I understand that you are saying that there is an insurable interest. Do you disagree with the general proposition that an insurable interest is necessary for there to be a valid insurance contract, and in the absence of an insurable interest, that the contract is void?
Well, that's what we're here to talk about. I do agree with the proposition of that there should be an insurable interest to insure a vehicle for New Horizons to have insured that vehicle. However, Colorado Revised Statute 10-4602 states that once a insurance attaches, to either rescind, cancel, modify, or delete coverage after it's been in effect for 60 days, there are specific steps that must occur.
Pardon me for interrupting again, if I may, but that goes to the second part of my question. If there is no insurable interest and the contract is void, then doesn't that mean that that statute is not pertinent because there has been no contract from the inception?
I would argue no, because the reason the statute allows 60 days is for the carrier to do their underwriting, to ask the questions that they need to ask, to determine whether they are properly insuring a vehicle, to obtain all the information they need. And because it's specific, because the statute specifically says, once, regardless of fault, once coverage attaches, even if it does so under, assumptions by either of the parties, that irrespective of those assumptions, you have a valid insurance policy. Without so would violate public policy. People would be driving around. They would not know whether they had car insurance. They added a car. They paid the premium.
Let me interrupt for a second there. On the facts of this case, who would have standing to complain about that? Wouldn't it be the insureds, New Horizon, and not Ms. Reedy? They would it's their policy, and you would be saying that this would apply to them, that they would have to provide.
Well, yes, sir. In fact, I would agree with that, but through the policy, it's not uncommon that there are third-party beneficiaries. If you and I were riding in your vehicle, and I could sue your insurance company if they didn't provide me MedPay, because I'm a third-party beneficiary to your insurance contract, and through our being together, I've established a quasi first-party relationship with your insurance company because they owe me benefits. So it's not unusual where the recipient of benefits are a third-party beneficiary to a contract.
So, Mr. Bendinelli, do I understand correctly that your approach on this case is that coverage did attach?
And admitted so during the trial by Mountain States. They said there was a valid insurance contract. And their expert agreed that there was an insurable interest. So, yes, but getting back to something you said earlier, is it appropriate for an insurance carrier to shift the burden of underwriting to an insured? And really, in essence, what this case was is this car was on this policy for over a year. In fact, in the exhibits given to the court, there was a, once a call was made, there was a specific endorsement. That was from the plain language from Mountain States. It says this overrides any prior, this becomes part of the policy, this amends the contract, and I know the defendant argued that there was these generic language about symbols and ownership in the policy. But those symbols were generic language. I mean, it was trumped by a specific endorsement, specifically naming the car, naming the coverage, and it was attached to the policy. And Richard Logeson, our expert, testified that not only would that trump the generic symbol language, but it was done later in time. And I believe the example he used is, what if it said, the policy said that 1999 Mercury Sable had previously been specifically excluded in the policy? And then there's a specific endorsement issued by the carrier a year later saying that now there's coverage on that 1999 Mercury Sable. And it didn't even, their exclusion of the car did not even rise to a specific exclusion, followed by the specific endorsement.
Let me ask you this, because this is where it seems to be a premise of your argument, and where I'm having a little difficulty. It is my understanding that for there to be an insurable interest, excuse me, for there to be a policy, there must be an insurable interest. And if there's no insurable interest, then you never have a policy. It is void ab initio, and coverage never attaches. Do you agree with that?
Sir, I would point out that the defendant was unable to cite any authority for that proposition. There is none.
So you don't agree with that?
Well, but we're not talking about a ship from the 1800s. We're talking about, you know, in this day and age where there are specific statutes crafted and constructed to cover this type of situation. You know, it's mandatory that we have auto insurance, and the state has an interest in making sure that its citizens are insured. And there are provisions to cover this exact type of circumstance. But nonetheless, there was an insurable interest. There was a plethora of evidence and testimony as to the benefits that Ms. Reeby conferred upon New Horizons. And not only that, their expert admitted that if Ms. Reeby was riding Randy Nelson somewhere on company business and was in an accident, could not New Horizons then therefore be liable? And the expert admitted, the Mountain States expert admitted, yes. And that that alone would establish an insurable interest in that vehicle.
And it would, I'll ask you twofold. One is, in the testimony of that witness, but also in your analysis, it would establish that the policy was not void ab initio.
Right, and I believe the statute and the insurance regulation state that.
Right. And then the second piece of that is, well, if it was not void ab initio, was it a policy that only provided coverage when Ms. Reeby was on New Horizons business, or was it a policy that provided her coverage throughout the day, every day?
No, sir. In our firm, we have commercial auto policies, and our vehicles are on there. And if the vehicle qualifies to be on a commercial policy, they can't say it, you know, 458 today. There's no coverage. I mean, once you're insured through some type of business interest, that policy lasts the entire term and does not kick in or not apply at certain times of the day.
Okay.
I would just point out that the reason that 10-4-602 was drafted and enacted is because without some type of assurance, there is chaos. People would be riding around, as in this case, for over a year with, and I'll just mention some of the exhibits that were provided to the court. Mountain States obtained Ms. Reeby's name, date of birth, social number, driver's license number, and in their file, they had pulled her driving record prior to this loss. Also, they issued a policy specifically identifying, she was listed on the schedule of drivers, and not only that, but the policy was specifically listed as well with the vehicle identification number. So you had they issued a policy. They obtained her driving record. They calculated and charged for a premium through a renewal cycle, and they took the money.
Excuse me, a premium for what?
For coverage on this automobile.
On the car?
Yes, sir.
Did they return that money?
I'm sorry?
Did they return that money?
Well, they would argue that they did, but at the end of the day, New Horizons owed the broker some money, so they issued a credit, but there was never any real pecuniary recovery to Ms. Reeby. You know, they balance charged it, so to speak.
Does it matter whether New Horizons or Ms. Reeby paid the premium?
No.
Okay.
No, I pay for my son's premium. That doesn't mean my son doesn't have car insurance. Let's hope so.
Okay.
They issued the specific endorsement with a letter saying that this, without restriction, that this becomes part of the policy. Not that it's to be construed together, although certain limitations and policy provisions would apply, there was no language in the policy that prohibited non-owned autos from being on that policy. In fact, there was testimony at the trial, they had about 12 or 15 vehicles insured. I think only two or three were owned by New Horizons. All of the vehicles on their policy, they were personal cars of either owners of the company or their wives or, in addition to that, they issued an insurance card, and there's a statutory provision that says that is evidence of insurance. And I'm going to save the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you. As you can see, you have about 50 seconds. Proceed.
Thank you. Counsel, may it please the court, my name is Robert Zupkis, and today I have the pleasure of representing Mountain States Mutual Casualty. And with me at counsel table is Mr. David Hilliard, who is the individual that supervises Colorado claims on behalf of Mountain States. And over time, great actors such as Gregory Peck and Raymond Burr have had the opportunity to play very prominent lawyers who have had a great influence on at least the society of the movies that they populated. And I'm certain that neither Mr. Peck nor Mr. Burr had an opportunity to discuss the applicability of Rule 59 and the application of Rule 59. And I'm sure they're disappointed that they didn't have that opportunity in their career. But this is a case about Rule 59. And this is a case that, if you look at it, never should have gone to the jury. It was a case that indeed should have been governed by application of Rule 56 and application of undisputed law to undisputed fact. And unfortunately, Rule 56 did not carry the day in this case. And I think that we can all understand why Rule 56 is not a rule that is often supported because by trial judges, because they're hesitant to grant a Rule 56 motion for summary judgment because of the possibility that there's some disputed issue of material fact lurking out there somewhere. And the impulse of a trial judge is to be cautious and to allow the parties to have their day in court rather than face reversal on a motion for summary judgment. And in this case, though, the parties had multiple days in court, as Mr. Bendinelli has pointed out. Ms. Reby was given every opportunity by three different trial judges she was given the benefit of every doubt that three different trial judges could have had about this particular case. And then her case was fully presented because there were previous motions for summary judgment under 56. And she had every opportunity to meet her burden of proof at the trial. And she could not do that. And Judge Robbins' very succinct two-page order, which is dated July 29th, 2008, cuts through the extraordinary clutter of unmaterial facts and the extraordinary clutter of what happened in terms of trial to get to the heart of the matter. And we've seen, and we'll talk about in a minute, some of the extraneous facts, the clutter that were not material facts. We've heard those discussed by Mr. Bendinelli. Judge Robbins' order went to the heart of the undisputed matter, and that is, number one, this was a commercial auto policy. It was issued to a company called New Horizon. Ms. Reby had no involvement with either the policy or New Horizon. She was not a named insured. She had nothing to do with the business of New Horizon. She was not an employee. She was not an investor, a stockholder. She happened to live with one of the officers of New Horizon. That's it. It's also clear, as pointed out by Judge Robbins, that New Horizons never owned or leased this Mercury Sable. And those are conditions that are absolutely required by the terms, the unambiguous terms of the policy. So this car was never eligible for coverage So therefore, there was never coverage for this particular car.
Mr. Zupkus, if I may interrupt you, please.
Sir.
That goes to the question I asked Mr. Bendinelli. Was this contract void, and or was it voidable?
It was void.
What then is the effect of the statute to which Mr. Bendinelli referred on this contract?
In this particular case, it's not applicable at all. And the reason is that the policy itself was never canceled. The coverages in terms of dollar amounts or categories of coverage were never altered. There was never a reason to give notice because this car from the inception was not eligible under this commercial auto policy. So it was never covered. It was not a case where there was coverage that was extended and then withdrawn. And Judge Robbins properly noted that and properly applied the unambiguous terms of the contract.
I mean, you say it was not extended by naming the vehicle on the policy, that's not extending coverage?
No, because the fact that the automobile is listed or named as a Mercury Sable does not, if using the term of Mr. Bendinelli, trump the policy language that says you still have to be either a named insured and the vehicle has to be owned or leased by a named insured. And the schedule itself of cars refers back to the fact that this is a schedule of cars owned by the insured.
What about your expert's testimony that, well, there might have been coverage or there was, I don't remember the exact testimony, but certainly the testimony indicated that there were some circumstances under which there were coverage.
That was part, frankly, of kind of the smoke and din of trial in terms of cross-examination. And we are only looking at the medical pay benefits and we are looking at the UIM benefits. We're not looking at the liability issues or damnification that Mr. Laugesen talked about and whether there might have been liability coverage that might have attached in some fashion or another. Or liability that would have attached to New Horizon, which may have given an insurable interest. This is a situation where you still just can't insure something you don't own. And we're not looking at liability insurance. We're looking at UM insurance, UIM insurance, and medical payments insurance.
So would it be that if this car were covered for, it was, at least the policy said, for liability and medical payments in UM, UIM, if there had been some possibility of liability, then the policy would not have been void, but the UM, UIM, and medical payments coverage portions of it would be void?
No. This is a case where it would have been just void, but we never got into that debate where there was no need to get into that debate about liability coverage. There was cross-examination about it, okay, but that wasn't the issue here.
Okay. Well,
In terms of what the expert for Mountain States was trying to explain, is that even if you accepted somehow that there was an insurable interest under the damnification theory, if you read the whole of his testimony, what he was saying is that by the time this accident happened, there was no insurable interest. It never existed, and if under some stretch of the imagination it did exist, it didn't exist at the time of the accident. But that was by way of explanation.
I'm still trying to follow up on my colleague's questions about that. When you say, okay, there was no insurable interest, so it was void from the inception. What is the it that we're talking about? Is it just the coverage on this car?
Yes.
Or is it the whole policy?
Just this car. And again, the insurable interest issue was one of the many red herrings, if you will, in this case. And interestingly, if you look up red herring in Wikipedia, it says that a red herring is a fish that doesn't exist and was never a fish that was used to train hunting dogs, but a columnist in 1807 and 1833 in England used the term frequently, and it created an idiom which had a life of its own. So this is doubly applicable here. There were a lot of red herrings that were strewn about the trial to try to distract what the true result should be. But in fact, and those red herrings included insurable interest, it included that the policy was canceled. It included the schedule of drivers, which was never part of the policy. It included the fact that the car was listed on a schedule of cars that was in the policy, but that schedule on its face said you still have to own or lease these cars. There were multiple red herrings.
Mr. Zupkus, pardon me, and I apologize if I may seem dense here, but I want to go back to something.
Yes.
It's again the voidable issue. You said that if this were a liability issue, that it would still be void. I understand that you're saying it's not a liability issue, but isn't there at least some support for the concept that Mr. Bendinelli's talking about in the Mrs. Condi's case?
No, I don't agree with that, Judge.
All right, would you explain to me why not?
Yes, because in this particular case, this particular policy, and we have to look at the specific policy in terms of reaching a decision. This one said that to get on this commercial policy, you have to either own it or lease it. And that was abundantly clear, unambiguous. There was no finding of any ambiguity about that. And the New Horizon did not own or lease this car. The policy also had, as also named insureds, two of the owners of New Horizon. They were listed as named insureds. So in the examples Mr. Bendinelli was giving about his commercial auto policy for his firm not switching on or off, if these individuals were driving a company car or a car that they owned or leased, they were covered because they were named insureds.
Would they be covered regardless of what car they were driving?
It still had to be listed.
Okay.
Still had to be a listed car owned or leased.
Okay.
And one of the things that, again, that if you look at the transcript, what Judge Robbins was looking for in terms of a potential disputed fact was whether there was some sort of constructive lease or a written lease. He said that, and we quoted from the record where when he denied the motion for directed verdict and basically said that's the issue we're going to continue to examine.
Putting aside the question of what the language in the policy specifically states, and I recognize that's an integral part of the analysis, but putting that aside, are you aware of any Colorado cases that stand for the proposition that if you don't have an insurable interest, the policy is void ab initio, and then are you aware of any Colorado cases that define an insurable interest? Is doing errands enough? Are there any cases that give us any guidance on that?
If there are, Your Honor, and I would have cited them, I did cite them in the pleadings, and nothing comes to mind as I stand here right now.
Okay,
but the Hornbook law and the whole theory of insurance is you can't insure something you don't own. And the reason is because you can't insure somebody else's car and then hope it burns up so that you get money for it. The check, if this car burned up, the check was going to go to New Horizon. They didn't own this car.
What if they leased?
Mrs. Reby did. That's the fundamental principle here.
But you just talked earlier about if they leased it, that might have been an issue.
Oh, sure, because...
So we've already started up a ladder. We've got ownership and we've got leasing. Is there anything else or is that it?
That's it. The lease, first of all, it's in the policy. Second of all, it's modern-day business. People, individuals even lease cars. They don't own it. GMAC still owns it, but they pay the lease. And therefore, it's their obligation to pay off the lease. They have that insurable interest, that risk. And if the car burns up, the check's going to get issued to GMAC and, in the case I just gave, New Horizon.
But what if upon Ms. Reby's request, New Horizon had said, okay, we've got a deal for you. We'll go ahead and put this on our policy, but we want to enter into a contract with you that you will... do errands for us, we'll drive the president around because he can't drive, and they signed an agreement to that effect.
You know,
would that be an insurable interest?
If there was a lease, even though it was such as you described, which we might not say lawyers drafted, but I would say if there was a legitimate lease and a lease understanding, yes, there would be coverage. And in fact, in the facts of this case, the agent was involved as a defendant in this case at one time. There was communication between the agent and New Horizon saying, give us a lease, give us anything. And in fact, the email said, do you have anything in writing that would show that this was a leased vehicle? That you had some written understanding that New Horizon was leasing it from Ms. Reby. But in any event, one of the things I do want to point out is what Judge Robbins, when he, in his two-page order, he understood the test that was to be applied. He understood that this was an either-or test, that about insufficient evidence as a matter of law or no evidence and judgment should be entered in favor of, in this case, Mountain States as a matter of law. He applied the right test. You have the opportunity to review it de novo, but the test is still the same, and it's an either-or test. It's not an and test. And I think that Judge Robbins correctly pointed out that neither A or B of the test was satisfied by Ms. Reby, and in fact, Mountain States had shown in this motion for judgment notwithstanding the verdict, and after all the evidence came out from either side, that Rule 59 was appropriate and a judgment was granted notwithstanding the verdict. And that rule is not the same straitjacket that 56 is. 56 says you have certain evidence that you can present, certain information. 59 is everything that comes in during the course of the trial, and it's seen unadulterated by the judge, and he or she can then make the determination, if you will, was there anything that was material, that was disputed, that should go to the jury, or is it a matter of law? And Judge Robbins said, matter of law, no evidence that was material or disputed. Rule 59 was designed to provide a simple method of assuring without the expense, delay, and uncertainty of a new trial that the case is delighted, that the case is decided in the under the substantive rules of law and according to the evidence presented in the case. That's a Columbia Law Journal site, but it's not in our briefs. But that is why 59 is here, and it's different than 56. Judge Robbins was correct. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Bendinelli.
Since I only have 50 seconds, I have 4 points. I'm just going to read them. This is auto coverage, not property coverage. The public policy considerations are enormous. What we have here is post-loss underwriting. UIM always covers non-owned, it's the occupants. Randy Nelson was a named insured. That was his only transportation for over a year. If the policy was void, why did they issue an endorsement deleting it later? The argument that there was never any coverage, which was contradicted by their expert and the head of underwriting, is a fiction. There was coverage. Can't say it just went away. They issued a specific endorsement after the loss that deleted the coverage. They wouldn't have had to do that if it was void ab initio. Ownership requirement is not in the policy. Leasing requirements is not in the policy.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Is that it, Judge?
Yep.
My 5th second.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. That was helpful. The case will stand submitted. We will issue an opinion in due course. I thank you for your arguments. We'll call the next case as soon as...